Ainda não. Sociologia e utopia.
Bem-vindas e bem-vindos ao 15º episódio do podcast Ainda não, Sociologia e Utopia. O convidado de hoje é Seth Holmes, que tivemos o prazer de receber no Porto em 2022. Médico e antropólogo da Universidade de Califórnia, Berkeley, e com um extenso trabalho etnográfico com trabalhadores migrantes agrícolas nos Estados Unidos.
First, we'll ask you, what are your major concerns, your political and social concerns right now, in this moment, and your place, I don't know, United States or in the world?
Yeah. Oof, good question. I think my main concerns are that there's some forms of violence and some forms of understanding specific groups of people as less human or not human that then allow people not to talk about violence, not to talk about social inequalities, not to be upset by or not to be vocal about wars that are going on. I think the main thing that concerns me is that there are wars, there is extreme violence, there's growing and extreme social inequalities. And, you know, we know statistically, for example, on one side, that within all societies, the life expectancy of people who are homeless is roughly half the life expectancy of people who are housed. We also know that there are wars going on in multiple parts of the world. Palestine, Israel is one, but there I know of four more, and I bet there are others that I don't know about. And yet in the midst of these different forms of violence and inequalities that we know harm people, there isn't enough political will or collective social will to speak out and say enough is enough, this isn't okay, this has to change. So there is some collective will, and that gives me hope. But my main concern is the partial invisibilization or the partial silencing of a collective ethical outcry about humans and non-humans and environments that are being exploited and extracted or destroyed.
And do you consider that utopia has been present in your work as a researcher? Mm-hmm. And if so, in what ways?
Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason I do my work is that I have hope that the way things are could be different, partially because I've seen some places and contexts in which things are more fair, in which work relations are more fair, in which diversely racialized people are treated more fairly, are included, are agents in and understood to be agents and heard when they speak or are paid attention to when they act. Part of it is that I see some collectives of people, both, for example, binational indigenous people and indigenous people in diaspora, because I work mostly with indigenous people from Mexico who work as migrant farm workers in the US, but also collectives of workers and collectives across social difference that are in solidarity for a cause, that are pushing for something different. And that gives me hope. But I think the utopia that I understand is a more real, thorough form of democracy where everyone's priorities and voices and views, regardless of how marginalized, are part of the process and part of the conversation, and where no one is devalued or considered unhuman or not human or not valuable, because there are non-human beings and who are also important, including our environment, who, you know, feeds us and gives us water and lets us live. And then when I see that fairer world being contradicted or refused, then I'm angry. And so part of the reason I do my work is this kind of anger at, like, well, this does not have to be this way. How did we get to this food system that, in the midst of feeding ourselves and others, we're doing violence to people and we're causing harm to them? How are we okay with that? And how can we then move toward a system that feeds us, that is more fair and healthy and respectful and dignified for everyone? And how can we listen to the people who are marginalized or excluded or dominated or oppressed or partially invisibilized or partially silenced within the food system about their experiences and their hopes and their priorities and what the utopia that they work toward and hope for and imagine, or don't have much hope for but wish could be true?
Mm-hmm. You work with really vulnerable groups, social groups. How do you think that, in a way that the hope or the belief that things can change help you to deal with disappointment, with angriness, as you said, with blockage, with everything?
I remember when I was finishing my PhD project, actually, I went to two of my advisors, Philippe Bourgois and Nancy Shepherd Hughes, who both work on topics that are difficult with people who are marginalized and dominated. And I asked them, how do you not get depressed? Because I was starting to feel like, you know, crap, there's so many vested interests. There's so many powers that are aligned for this system to be unequal and violent in the way that it is. And I started feeling depressed. And then when I was writing the conclusion to my book, I started the conclusion with reading people and thinking about what is hope and where does it come from and how does it work, because I didn't have that much at the time. I think seeing some of my book just came out in a second edition with a new epilogue where I interviewed all the people in the book, the kind of protagonists in the book who I'm still in touch with. And some of them have been involved in starting a new migrant farm worker union that's primarily led by Indigenous migrant farm workers. And they, you know, they haven't gotten rid of racial capitalism and they haven't gotten rid of all social inequalities and exploitation, but they have achieved really important and big successes, actually, where, for example, they started on one particular farm, mostly in one region with people related to other farms. And then they ended up suing the entire state for allowing workers to not be given lunch breaks and bathroom breaks and breaking kind of labor laws. And they won. So then not just where they worked, but every single farm in the whole state had to then change how they act and be aware that they could be enforced for actually giving lunch breaks and bathroom breaks to people. It doesn't change the whole unequal system, but that's a pretty big deal that they fought for something that affected not only them, but probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And then some of the people who from the book got involved with a big national migrant farm worker union, pushing the state of California to include all people, regardless of immigration status, in health insurance. So then, the first time it didn't pass, and they kept going back to the state capitol and meeting with people. And the second time it did pass. And so now, if you're in the state of California, which, you know, is huge, actually, I don't know how many Portugals fit in the state of California, but several, you know, it's big, it's a big state. Now everyone, undocumented, documented, in process, can have health insurance. And that's a big deal because it's good for everybody to have everyone be healthy. And then some of them got involved with a binational indigenous Mexican organization pushing for overtime pay, kind of another loophole where there are certain labor laws in the US, but migrant farm workers are excluded explicitly. This labor law does not apply to them. And there's several of those. So one of those is being paid overtime if you work more than 40 hours a week in a job where you're paid per hour. So, and they, the first time that did not pass, and the second time it did. So I've also been, I stay in touch with those people, and I care about them, and they care about me. And I'm kind of moved by that sometimes I'll get a message on WhatsApp or something from one of the migrant farm worker families or someone, one of the migrant farm workers or their kids, just asking how I am, you know, how are you doing? How are your parents? And that human interaction is a part of what maybe J.K. Gibson Graham might encourage us to be involved in, these other forms of interacting that are not capitalist transactional interactions, so that our way of understanding who we are and what it means to be human can be more than transactional and can be something else. And then part of the way I do my work is listening to the people I work with and seeing what they're doing and being inspired by them and trying to follow their lead how I can about what's important to them, kind of what they hope will change. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, yes, a lot, because I was really touched with your talk when you came to Portugal, and I was wondering how can researchers handle with that, because you're in the field, you're not just in a in the office seeing graphs or numbers about the diseases of the people or other stuff.
Right. So I think tomorrow I go to Madeira, where most of the migrant farm worker families live, and I'll be living with one of the families for the next days and kind of catching up. And we worked on a film together that the second generation made about their families. And now we're talking about whether we want to work on another project that's related to the second generation and how they kind of navigate all the inequalities and what they hope for in the future and what challenges they come up against and what strengths they and their families and communities kind of provide to help navigate it. So, yeah, I'm go ahead.
No, well, just asking, because you were talking about their hope about the future, and I would like for you to tell me what are your hopes for the future. If you could design the perfect society, at least in a, not in a big scale, but in your scale, in your world, what will be the priorities? What will be the biggest changes that you would like to happen?
That's a good question. I think on one hand, it seems like there are two levels on which, I mean, at least, but two levels I can think of on which change needs to happen. One is kind of the material structural level. Like everyone needs some kind of housing if they want it, you know, everyone needs somewhere to be. Everyone needs some protection from the elements if they want that, and protection from kind of other form, you know, violence and insecurity in different ways, including violence and insecurity from the police and the state sometimes, or regularly or often. And wars need to stop, and colonialism needs to stop. You know, I mean, I've been also grateful and honored to start working with some health professionals in Western Sahara, and I've been learning more about Western Sahara's history with colonialism and contemporary experiences of colonialism. And you know, several years ago, I didn't know about that at all. And so I'm moved by them, and they inspire me at the same time that I'm a little depressed that there's another form of dehumanization and violence going on that I didn't know about. So there's one level that's kind of the structural level. And then the other level is the level of kind of the meanings that are attached to different groups of people and the meanings that are attached to different categories of people, who's understood to be trustworthy and who's not trustworthy and who deserves being listened to and being cared for and who doesn't, and who is human and who's not quite human, and who is an agent whose statements count as statements from a person and whose statements don't count because they are considered not a subject but abject, or they're considered crazy or something. And on that level, that's kind of where I have this belief in some, or hope for some real deep form of democracy where the demos, the collective across difference, can have solidarity and work through differences and listen to the people who are especially pay attention to and listen to the people who are more dominated, are more marginalized, don't have housing, are being attacked. Or so those two levels are really important. And I have hope that my work is engaging in this level mostly, and like trying to challenge the way people are categorized and what meanings they hold, and trying to share words and statements and stories and experiences from people who want them shared, and sharing them with them, or supporting them sharing them, or bringing them myself to places if that's what they want. And the other side, the structural side, is also really important, and getting involved with social movements that are pushing for housing or ceasefire, or you know, the king of Morocco, who is part of keeping the colonialism in Western Sahara active, not to be the head of human rights for the United Nations, because how can you be the head of human rights if you are actively engaged in oppressive colonialism, et cetera? So, but there, those are the two levels I think of. And I've reread, I don't know if how much it, they're read in Portugal, but the Combahee River Collective. Mm-hmm. They were a group of mostly Black mostly women, many of whom are queer, if I remember correctly, in the 1970s, who wrote a statement about interlocking systems of oppression and how all of us, regardless of how oppressed or not oppressed or oppressing we are in this system of interlocking oppression. And this kind of call for everyone, anyone coming from their own social position within those structures, coming to recognize these interlocking systems of oppression and be in solidarity to undo those systems of oppression. And this call for kind of analysis from multiple different perspectives that is in solidarity together to change the system that in the end makes everyone precarious, even if it makes people very differently precarious. You know, we know from epidemiology that the more unequal a society is, the worse the health of even the rich people is. The health of the poorer people is worse, and the unhoused people, but the more inequality there is, even the well-off people are worse off, and they would be better off if they were less rich and there was more equality and equity. Yeah, we can think about other, you know, thinkers who've said related things in different ways, like Paulo Freire. But I've been thinking some with the Combahee River Collective statement and some of the people who, Kianga Yamada Taylor, who follows up from them in this call for solidarity across difference that is both about who's included in decisions, but also really about material and structural things, who has access to food and healthcare and health and housing and not being bombed. And that's really important. I think right now is a, for me and a lot of people I know, I think right in my mom, for example, right now is a hard time to be hopeful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's been true at different times through my life, but it feels especially dark right now in that way. And so sometimes I have to engage with other people to say something or write something that's challenging some of the dehumanization or the domination that's happening of people or environments. And then sometimes I need to go to a demonstration that says, you know, a demonstration, for example, I'm also a medical doctor as well as a social anthropologist. So sometimes I need to go to a demonstration as with a bunch of medical doctors and medical students and nurses and say, it's not okay to bomb hospitals. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's not okay. Or go with a group of professors and teachers and say, it's not okay to bomb schools. You know, you don't get to do that. Not that it's okay to bomb other things, but from that particular social position to say, look, I know something about hospitals and what they do and what they're important for, and this is not okay. And sometimes being around those other people gives me hope that I'm otherwise, sometimes if I'm just thinking about it on my own, it's not so hopeful. Yes. I also was going to say this might be weirdly American version of disclosure or something, but in my family, sometimes we share kind of a list of things we're grateful for, and then we share a list of things we're not grateful for. And the idea is that over time, the intention is that over time, it helps you move more towards things you're grateful for and away from things you're not grateful for, just because you keep mentioning some things that's on the same list. And it's been interesting for me that I don't think I somehow didn't understand or foresee how personal and human being an ethnographer is. Because when I do that list of things I'm grateful for, a lot of the migrant farm workers I work with are on that list. Not because I'm grateful they give me information and help me write an article, but because they care about me, like as a human, you know? Mm-hmm. I remember there was this one, for the last 10 years or something, when I give a talk about my work with migrant farm workers, if it's possible, anywhere in California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, or sometimes other places, if it's possible, virtually or whatever, I ask the university or the conference to invite one of the migrant farm worker families also to come with me. And so either we give a presentation together or I give my normal presentation and then they get to kind of comment on it and also answer questions afterwards. And in one of those, it was several years ago now, one of the people in the audience asked, a student, I think, asked one of the person in the book whose name is Samuel. They asked Samuel, what did you think about Seth when you first met him? And I had asked that question, but I'm me. And so they probably answer a little bit differently to me. So what they said to this person, which I had never heard, was, you know, we were living in this labor camp with our families, and he was living alone in the labor camp, and he was lonely, and we reached out to care for him. And that was kind of mind-blowing to me, because in all the discussions of like sociological, anthropological, ethnographic ethics and relational ethics and everything, I don't remember ever anyone talking about that. It may have happened and I missed it, and sorry if I did, but we talk a lot about ourselves as the agents and that our actions, and but we don't always talk about how sometimes ethnography happens because the people around us are human and they see that we're human and they see that we're vulnerable and they know that they're vulnerable and they reach out, and that's also touching. Anyway, and then sometimes we, you know, the other part of the discussion of ethics that I don't see that's really important, that kind of makes me angry that it's not the most important thing, is social justice should be the most important ethic, not just the little tiny micro actions we do. That's so self-centered to focus ethics just on us. It's ridiculous and totally, usually, not totally, but largely anti-political. What if every time we talk about research ethics, we talk about, is your research making the world better or not? Mm-hmm. And that's the main conversation. And then we talk about the little ways in which it's making, working towards the world being better or not, and how we know. And the, but if we only talk about, are you, you know, engaged in these very much based in a kind of Western idea of autonomous individuals' way of interacting with each person you interact with, then we're not even very good social scientists, you know? It's almost like we haven't even paid attention to social theory. Of course, those things are important. Those micro-level actions we do in research are important, but the bigger focus on ethics, I think, should be on kind of what dystopia are you confronting and what utopia are you working for, and how do you know that is a utopia that's helpful, not just for you? So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking me questions and talking today.
Ainda não. Sociologia e Utopia.